This is a tape of the Alan Young lecture, Can You Simply Trust? This lecture was recorded as he gave it in a branch church in Evanston, Illinois in 1973. Although Mr. Young is no longer active in the church organization, he is still a dedicated Christian Scientist, loyal to Mary Baker Eddy and her teachings. We begin his lecture as he is acknowledging his introduction given by a member of the church, Mr. Young.
While we're saying thanks, I would like to say how grateful we are for the young adults in this church, the young members who were responsible for setting up all the television equipment so that they could be viewed downstairs and across the street. That's just great. Thank you. And I'd also like to acknowledge the obviously Sunday school age students here today and downstairs. And to them, I'd like to say, I'm sorry I'm working alone tonight. But my partner just couldn't make it. See, a lecture tour such as this, one depends upon traveling by train and by car and by boat and by plane. And in fact, when I bought the tickets, the man selling them took one look at this bulging envelope. He said, Mr. Young, it looks like you're going to find out what it is to work like a horse. But he knew, as we all know, that there's just no labor at all involved when it comes to trusting God. And that's what tonight is all about. Right now, I'd like to put you all to work on this lovely, balmy evening. It's very simple work, just to think back, if you would, to this morning when you woke up, and consider if you think you've placed any trust in anything today, any little trust in any little or big thing. I'm sure you'd all agree, we'd be surprised how much trust we're placing daily, hourly, minute by minute. Recently, in flying from Los Angeles to Boston and back in almost the same day, I placed a great deal of trust. Not in the young lady with the coffee, tea, or milk. Not in the pilot, however expert he might be. Nor did I place my trust completely in that marvelous structure called a 747. But the pilot, the entire airline personnel, were placing their trust in a law. The law of aerodynamics. The plane itself was built to conform to that law exactly. And the pilot knew that when he set his instruments and accelerated, went forth speedily, confidently, why, the plane would naturally lift off the ground. And it did. Oh, we were tickled about that right away, you know. But the pilot's trust, it was simple and it was complete. And the pilot had to trust in every phase of this operation. He just couldn't trust halfway. I mean, he just couldn't accelerate and not elevate. Otherwise, we never would have. Well, we would have made great mileage, but I mean, we wouldn't have got up where we belonged. And driving over here this evening, I'm sure many of you drove right through the green traffic light, trusting the other one was red. Great trust was expressed this morning when we turned the light switches on and expectancy. And if my light hadn't gone on, would I immediately phone the electric company and tell them all about it? Of course not. I would check the bulb first. The electric light won't work unless the bulb is fully committed. I'm sure you see what I'm getting at. In order for law to be effective, we must be in complete accord with it. So, let's consider the law of God in this respect. Are you a fully committed bulb? Or are you just partially screwed in? Are you wobbling around a little bit? Well, no wonder we don't make contact. Our trust must be complete, our commitment entire. Then we shall make contact. Then this law of God will be operating on our behalf completely, perfectly. This highway code, which safely controls and harmoniously governs the flow of traffic, doesn't contain laws that can cause accident. Disobedience, ignorance, compromise with these laws is what brings about the inharmony. Now, these human, sometimes fallible, laws serve to indicate faintly the infallible, continually governing law of God. God's law is the revealed truth of God's allness, including his idea, man. Not material, but spiritual, man. Mary Baker Eddy, who discovered and founded Christian Science, writes of God's law in very simple terms in one of her prose works. She says, God's law reaches and destroys evil by virtue of the allness of God. God's law is in three words, I am all. And this perfect law is ever present to rebuke any claim of another law. God's law does not contain a sentence or a suggestion of inharmony. The entire purpose of God's law, this law of good, is to benefit and to bless his precious children. It's the simplicity of our trust in this law of good that we shall be dwelling with in this short talk tonight. Is this a little loud for you, this loudspeaker? Is it all right? All right. Some years ago, I took my then 4-year-old son out for the first walk with just father and son. Prior to this, he'd been in the loving care of his mother, but now it was a lovely Sunday afternoon and a time for the two fellows to spend a little afternoon together. And it's a big time in the life of a new father, and I think in the life of a little boy. At least mine was all dressed in his best. And as we walked out the front driveway, a little friend of his from across the street yelled out, "Hey, Cam, where are you going?" Well, my son drew himself up to his full height, which was then about 2'9". And he said, well, he didn't say anything. It seemed he announced to the whole neighborhood, "I'm going with my father." And that's all. Well, his little friend went back in the house, and I noticed my son hadn't said where he was going, but simply, "I'm going with my father." This satisfied his little friend, and it certainly seemed to satisfy my son. And I wondered, what would be the basis for this satisfaction, this complete confidence? Wouldn't it begin with the fact that he knew his father loved him? Or perhaps first with the fact that he knew he loved his father. For as long as he could remember, his father had always supplied him with everything that was good for him. And if he obediently accepted, it was all he ever needed. Wasn't always all he ever wanted, you understand, but he knew it was all he would ever need. He knew his father would never lead him into a place of danger. And if he became afraid of anything along the way, he knew his father would always reveal to him how harmless it was and how unnecessary his fear was. He knew he could even let go of his father's hand, but his father wouldn't let go of his. When in a strange place, his father's eye was always on him, and it was an eye of love. He was confident in his obvious identity. He would always be his father's son. Now, as comforting as these words may be, again they indicate faintly the inseparability of God, divine mind, and this mind's own infinite idea, man, of which you and I, in our true spiritual identity, are the complete manifestation. Not a partial manifestation of the allness of God, nor a complete manifestation of just a part of God, but a complete and eternal, sinless expression of God's allness. This perfect state of being can be realized right now, and we can see it evidenced in all our human experience. An absolute acceptance of the divine fact that we are going with our Father includes an understanding of how we get there, when we get there, and what's there to greet us when we arrive. Any doubts along this line were anticipated and answered by the Bible statement, trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he will direct thy paths. Perhaps the best way I might indicate how we can begin to apply this wholehearted trust in all of our daily experience would be to tell you the story of a certain 17-year-old boy. Well, I'm going to tell the truth, it was me. I was that boy. So, 17 years old, this had to be 10, 12 years ago. Easily. Right here, I'd like to say I realize it would be immodest to tell stories about myself. These are stories on myself. There's quite a difference. It's about trust in God. In any case, at 17, I had just really begun the study of Christian Science and had been a patient at a Christian Science nursing home where I'd been healed of bronchial asthma through trust in and application of this law of God. But here I'd like to digress and tell you about my welcome into this nursing home, because to me, it was an example of the continual expectancy of good, which must always precede any sort of improvement, let alone a healing. This was a very small nursing home in Western Canada. It was really a house transformed into a nursing establishment. They had two registered Christian Science nurses and three trainees, just beginners. And they had a long waiting list waiting to get in this place, so they were pretty busy. Well, I was brought up and left at the front door, and the door was opened by the head nurse, and there, standing in front of her, she saw this vision. It was a sight, is what it really was, of a sad, pale, emaciated, totally doleful teenager. And she knew she had to say something right now that would break through this mesmerism of gloom and uplift consciousness a little bit. So as I recall, these were her words. She said, "Son, I hope you realize you're healing quickly because we need the sheets." I've been looking for a little sympathy, you know. But regardless of what this may sound like to some, this was not a facetious remark. This was not an unfeeling thing for her to say. This came from the depths of her spiritual intuition. She knew what I needed, and I needed just that. I needed some joy, first of all. I also needed to see her utter disregard for this physical picture that was crying out for human sympathy, which won't do anything for anybody, anytime, any place. She had love, and she had compassion. But above all, I needed to see her absolute conviction that my healing was inevitable. So is it any wonder that very night the healing came completely, permanently? However, at this particular time I began to speak of before digressing, I was on the top deck of a ship that was sailing me home from the nursing home about 6 weeks after this healing. I met a lady up there, and in the course of the conversation, noticing I was a teenager and I guess just making conversation, she asked what I intended to do for a living, and I mumbled something, and when she left, I realized I better give this some thought. Prior to this, I'd been in bed continually for over a year. And while having the loving help of teachers, which furthered my education, I had no career goal in mind. Frankly, I'd been just too busy trying to get better. But now it had to be given some thought. I reasoned that this same concept of God that had been turned to for the healing of a physical disease could surely be appealed to for the resolving of any and all discordant conditions. This reasoning is the beginning of what Christian Scientists call prayer. Prayer is the cultivation of that state of thought which continually acknowledges God's allness and accepts entirely the goodness of his creation. This prayer begins in the heart, and it need never reach the lips. For the second step in this prayer is not to audibly voice it, but to visibly live it. We cannot pray to God, who is perfect, to come down into our belief in evil and do something about it. Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and canst not look upon iniquity, said the prophet. Of purer eyes. I reasoned that my eyes, my vision, my consciousness needed to be purified. In other words, we begin by replacing these thoughts of criticism and impatience and jealousy and criticism and condemnation and bigotry and criticism and anger and judging and criticism. We replace it with thoughts of forgiveness and kindness and understanding and brotherly love. And as we begin these upward footsteps, we are replacing imperfection with a concept that is closer to perfection. And prayer is the pathway for these upward footsteps. In further considering this purification of thought, having just really begun the study of Christian Science, I was looking anywhere for inspiration. And when we do, we generally find it right where we are. I found it on the ship. Coming from a seaport, I knew that one of the hazards of shipping, certainly one of the nuisances of sailing, is this growth that attaches itself to the bottom of the ship. A few hundred years ago, when they had no protective paints or coatings that could minimize this growth, it became rather acute. What happens is that algae forms on the hull of the ship, and then barnacles grow there, and then seagrass and seaweed grow in amongst the barnacles. And then along float various crustaceans, which perhaps don't care for the wooden hull or the barnacles, but they love to nestle in with the seaweed. And so we have one intruder growing upon another. After being at sea for several months, this growth can reach a depth of up to 2 feet, cause resistance to the progress of the ship, put an imbalanced weight on the ship so that during a storm it might not answer to the helm as quickly as it should. This could be treacherous for the captain. In those days, he didn't have scuba equipment. He couldn't put men overboard to scrape it off. Quite a problem. But as with most problems, the solution is comparatively and generally simple. This captain would find the mouth of a river and then sail up that river as far as he could into the pure fresh water and there drop anchor. This sea growth, which is indigenous to salt water, just couldn't exist in this new environment. And that which didn't fall off in time of its own accord could be fairly easily removed by putting men overboard in the now calm waters. And so it is with the purification of thought. We don't need to probe or to scrape or to analyze or condemn ourselves, certainly not during an individual storm, but simply enter. Sail up that river of pure consciousness and anchor fast. This pure thinking comes from God, mind, and is potent to dissolve everything unlike itself. And we don't have to go anywhere or consult anybody to achieve this state. This is the very presence of the power of God. And it has been called the power of the presence of God. This is the Christ, ever present in human consciousness, to uplift human consciousness to an awareness of man's divine heritage, the blessed, innocent child of God. My need at that particular time then was not to plan desperately or to outline plaintively, but to trust completely God's direction and to pray as Jesus prayed, not my will, but thine be done. It's interesting, isn't it? Jesus didn't pray, not my will, but thine be done, but here's the way I see it. We cannot pray, thy will be done, in finding me a husband or a wife with blue eyes and red hair. or thy will be done in getting me a job as an electronics engineer in a plant somewhere in Florida during the winter months. Near the beach. But not right on the water where it's damp because of my condition. Well, if you'd heal that too, I'd appreciate it, you know. That's just not prayer, is it? That would be like taking a problem in mathematics and not working it out, but putting down an answer that we like.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not the right answer, but it's one we used before and it worked. It's agreeable. It's comfortable. And then we pray the principle of mathematics that it will somehow adapt itself so that this problem and our answer will coincide. If this were possible, mathematics would no longer be any sort of principle, but simply an adaptable, flexible theory. Well, God, divine mind, is not a compromising, flexible, theoretical being influenced by human wills and human desires. God is the principle of existence. But back to the fellow on the boat. We left him healed but unemployed, didn't we? And that's just halfway. And intelligence just doesn't leave us halfway. I reasoned that this same principle of existence must be applied to my own experience. At first, the thought came, as it sometimes comes when we just begin the study of Christian Science, oh, now, this is metaphysics, isn't it? Can you simply trust it? Will it work? I have such a small knowledge, such a limited grasp of this science. Will it work? Well, if a man is floundering down a well and a rope is thrown to him, how much of that rope does he have to get a hold of before he's pulled to safety? Just a small grasp on the very end will do it. It's all going up the same way. All right, having grasped, having taken hold, how do I begin to live this prayer? How do I begin to go with my Father? Well, I'd read in the Bible that God is love. I think it's printed somewhere around. Oh, there it is. Well, I thought I would try to live love. Love's always a good expression, a good beginning. Not man's love for anything, because true love is not a mere emotion. Love is an expression of God. And so if we are, or since we are reflecting or expressing love, we are in fact the expression or the reflection of God. And we can all recognize this love. It's expressed naturally, impartially. It waits for no request. It seeks no recipient. It just loves. Because it is love. The little rose doesn't wait for somebody to go by before giving off its perfume. Or check to see what they look like. It just pours it forth continually. Because that's its identity. So, upon getting back to our little community, I began to look around for ways in which I might try to express this higher sense of love, or at least do my best. And that's all that's expected of us, to do our best and leave the rest, because we're leaving it to God. I came across a little boy who was sick in bed. I went to his mother and asked if I might read to her son. There was no father in the household, so I could help her to get out and get her hair done or whatever she wanted to do. And she agreed. It was while reading to this little boy the telephone rang. It was the program director of a local radio station asking if I would give a comedy monologue on one of his programs that weekend. He'd heard me give it at some civic function, and he said, "I just thought of you." Well, I gratefully accepted and went on his program that weekend and appeared on it every week from there on. What had been thought of as nothing more than a loved hobby became a satisfying, exhilarating career. A career which lasted until just over 5 years ago, when I got into the big time here. And I mean that. What I don't mean to indicate is that God, the only intelligence, is aware of human persons and human predicaments. I remember the same little boy of mine, one night he was saying his prayers, and I overheard him say, "God, you didn't create evil. You don't even know evil. So you don't realize the trouble I'm having with my parents." And you know, that's true. God doesn't know our troubles. But think of it this way. That traffic light didn't know you were going by tonight. It was operating according to principle. You were operating the same way. The electric company didn't know we were going to turn all these lights on this evening. It simply stands as an ever-operative source of supply.